Club Friday Night with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio.
Thanks for joining us. It's Good Friday Night, and we have a rather good list of guests for you this evening. In just a moment, we're going to explore one of the treasures of the New South Wales State Library. It came into their hands following World War I, the gift of a grateful English family sent to Australia in memory of those Australian troops who did so much for England during the First World War. Contained in the gift, which was a bunch of Bibles, not insignificant Bibles, it included a Coverdale and a Tyndale Bible, which for those who know their antiquarian books are some of the rarest Bibles in existence, some of the first translations into English of the Bible out of the Greek and Latin. But also was a manuscript of music dating from the 14th century. It proved to be the work of an illustrator who provided those wonderful illuminations around the edges of the music from Italy, from the town of Rimini. It's become known as the Rimini Antiphonal. Not only, of course, was there manuscript, but the manuscript was of music, and the music has been given to us now to wondrous receptions in Sydney through the work of Neil McEwan and Meredith Lorne of the State Library, and Neil McEwan of the State Conservatorium of Music. They're going to join us in this hour. Following that, more music with John Carmody. John Carmody, our guest, around Easter and Christmas every year for the last couple of years, comes in to explore some of the rather interesting music created to enhance the season. Following John Carmody, Jim Wallace will join us. Jim Wallace, the author of God's Politics and more recently The Great Awakening, somebody who's looked at the way religion and politics have been interacting over the last 20 years and says some surprising things about the way religion is influencing our political life. Jim Wallace is one of those quoted by Kevin Rudd in his essay, Faith in Politics, which he contributed to the monthly magazine just before taking Labor to the election win in the last federal election. So stick around for Jim Wallace too. But now, the wonders of the Rimini Antiphonal. And we'll open with the music of Palestrina, Eterne Christe Munera. It's the St. Lawrence Singers under the direction of Neil McEwan.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the State Library of New South Wales. I'm Regina Sutton. I'm the State Librarian and Chief Executive. Before we begin tonight's performance, I would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people, who are the traditional custodians of this land. It's with real pleasure that I welcome you here tonight. We have many distinguished and talented guests here, and this is a very unique and special event. Tonight you will experience the first performance in Australia of the Rimini Antiphonal of 1328. It is clearly one of the treasures that the State Library has within its rare books collection. We're excited and privileged to hear this music because it hasn't been performed in over 600 years. The beautiful illuminations in the Antiphonal were created by the renowned 14th century Italian artist, Neri da Rimini. I would like to acknowledge a few key people that have enabled tonight's performance to be brought to you. Dr. Neil McEwen and the St. Lawrence Gregorian Scala and Singers for their preparation of the music that you will hear tonight. Thank you. I would like to now introduce Dr. Neil McEwen, who will discuss the process required to bring the music of the Antiphonal to life. Dr. McEwen is a lecturer at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music and a specialist in Gregorian chant.
Thank you and good evening, everybody. Tonight we're going to be involved in a performance of chants which have been selected from the Rimini Antiphonal. When I heard that the State Library of New South Wales housed a manuscript dated 1328, I just trotted up from the Conservatorium of Music and had a conversation with Meredith. And I mentioned to her, you realise, of course, that this is actually a music manuscript. It has very beautiful pictures, of course, and it is very famous because of the miniature artist. But actually, it's a document for singing, and it was used in the monastic institutes. The antiphonals for the hours of the day, the term Gregorian chant from Pope Gregory, he didn't write the chants, but he had them organised to be codified. It is believed that the melodies of the Gregorian chant were never written down at the time, and it took a monk in the Schola, who was probably illiterate anyway, it took about 10 years to remember the chants for the church's year, when you think of the Sundays and the feast days. After many hundreds of years, we now have back in our time the way that this music was presented. And what I have done is, with the Rimini manuscript, which doesn't show too much, I've gone back to the 10th century manuscripts, and I have transposed, with a little empathy, what I feel from the early manuscripts, what may be a performance practice of how the Rimini may have sounded in the 14th century. We will try and sing some of it for you. Thank you very much, everybody.
Music from 1328, from a particular place, Rimini in Italy. Produced in Sydney, Australia. Why? Because the music has found a home here. The original music. And the conductor of that presentation, that performance, is Neil McEwen. He's with us in the studio this evening, as is Meredith Lawn, the custodian of the music. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Neil, why perform a piece from 1328? What significance does it have for us here in Australia today?
Well, I'll let Meredith talk about the provenance of it and the history behind it, but it has a particular Australian theme about it. What is interesting to me is that it's a book that's here in Sydney in our State Library, and maybe some of the chants have not been heard for, you know, 500 or 600 years. We know that many of them would have been, but perhaps there are some unique possibilities of hearing some of these melodies that are that old. And I feel that this is a music manuscript and not just a book to be looked at.
It is a book to be looked at, Meredith, and a very beautiful book too. Indeed, its name, the Rimini Manuscript, comes from not the musical source, but rather the artistic source, the person who actually transcribed this work or illustrated this work. Can you explain first what it is we are looking at? What is this object of value that Sydney has that has all this wonderful music in it?
Well, this is a volume called an antiphonal. It contains music for the service of the office, as opposed to a gradual, which is music for a mass. And it does contain the artistic work of a famous Italian illuminator from the 14th century, Neri da Rimini. But his name just means that he's of Rimini, which is the place in northern Italy. So calling it the Rimini Antiphonal, I think, is referring back to where it comes from and not just the artist.
Tell us what it looks like.
To start with, when you look at it from the outside, there are these wooden boards that are the covers. You open it up and you find that there are 155 vellum folios. And vellum is a specially treated animal skin, and so it doesn't lie completely flat. It's sort of a bit wobbly. And on many of the pages, we see beautiful illuminations by this artist.
By illuminations, you mean drawings and images.
Yes, and the colours seem to be just as vibrant today as they would have been when they were first created. And the gold leaf is very shiny, and so people are fascinated to see the beautiful illustrations that accompany the music.
And how many illustrated folios are there?
Well, there are 8 historiated letters. These are letters that have a little picture inside them that is relevant to the music and the words on the page. And then there are 21 decorated letters.
And this, and if we go back in time, this is clearly something that was highly valued. Putting something together like this back in the 14th century would have been a major undertaking for a local church.
And it would have taken hours and hours of painstaking work by the scribe, who did the words and the music, carefully copying it, trying not to make any mistakes. And then for the artist, and somebody of the calibre of Neri da Rimini, indicates that this was a very important antiphonal.
So we have 2 people involved in creating this work. The scribe,
that's right,
who copies out the chants, which are to be sung, and then giving it added lustre and value. Along comes an artist, Neri da Rimini, and illustrates, puts illustrations around these chants, these musical chants.
That's right. Yes.
So really there are 2 reasons for being excited about this piece of work. One is the artistic provenance and Neri da Rimini, and the other, Neil, is finding a set of chants on vellum that take us back to a certain period in time so we can get closer to
yes,
the way these things used to be performed.
Yes. We can never get, there's no such thing as authenticity, but we can try and get as close as we can. What was left on the pages, what is written on the pages, is purely the notation. So we don't know how that was sung, but we do have a key which I used, and that's to go back to the 10th century manuscripts and see what the signs were for the expression of the words, which are written down. But after a while, when the notation was written onto four lines for pitch, they gradually disappeared.
I'd like to have a talk about that in a moment. Before we do, let's have a listen to another one of the this beautiful set of chants as performed just recently in Sydney under the direction of Neil McEwen from the Rimini Antiphonal. Music of the Rimini Antiphonal. You're on Good Friday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. My guests, Neil McEwen and Meredith Lawn, bringing to Australia presentation of music that's been in our possession for some time, but only recently recovered and presented to the public. Neil McEwen, just before we heard that piece of chant, Gregorian chant, you were saying that you have to find ways of interpreting it. Music in the 14th century was written in a far more simple code than it is today. Can you explain how it was written out in the 14th century?
Yes, there are four lines, which are four red lines.
So it's a four-line stave, not four a five-line stave.
Line yes,
stave.
As invented by Guido di Arezzo in the 11th century. And this gives us the pitch. There's a signature there which tells us whether it's a C clef or an F clef. And then we can work out what pitches the notes are.
And is there any indication of the duration of the individual notes?
None at all, except one. One is left, which is a liquescent. If that means anything to anybody. It's just a liquescent really refers to going on to the next note very quickly, usually a consonant. Yeah.
Then how do you interpret something as bare and sparse as that for performance? I mean, what
what is the key to understanding it?
Well, the key is to go back to the 10th century manuscripts. There are three very important ones that have the key, and they are the Cantatorium from St. Gall, the manuscript from Laon in northern France, and one from the Abbey of Einsiedeln in Switzerland.
I understand that the way of decoding this material was only discovered as late as 1979, that for perhaps 500 to 800 years, the real art of interpreting Gregorian had been lost.
That's true. The publication was 1979, but the Salem monks have been working on the chants for over 100 years and didn't always agree with each other, except there was one particular man, and his name was Dom Eugene Cardine, and he was appointed by the Pope as professor in Rome of the Pontifical Institute, and he and his students really discovered what these little skirly, twirly things above the notes really actually meant. And they worked on it for a number of years. He was in Rome from the 1950s. And then in 1979, the publication came out of the Graduale Triplex. And it shows the signs, Guido's four lines, and above it's got the signs from one manuscript, and then below in red, the signs from another manuscript.
It's a bit like the Rosetta Stone, really.
It's a bit like that. It's exactly like that, actually. And you've got to know how to interpret these signs, but there are books that tell us this.
Now, you've brought that knowledge to this performance. So you've performed the Rimini manuscripts in the light of this 1979 knowledge about how to sing it.
Yes. By the time the Rimini manuscript would be sung from, there would have been an oral tradition which would have gone through, even though we have notes now that we can read. The oral tradition would have perhaps gone through to the 14th century, but gradually it died out. And then when we have the Council of Trent, there was a whole reform. By that stage, it had all gone. So I went back to the 10th century manuscripts, looked very close at the text that I had from the Rimini, and then I worked out what we call the semiology, that is putting back in to the chants, the signs and letters that are important from an earlier tradition. I think I've got perhaps reasonably close to what the chant may have sounded like in that time.
So this is not just an experience for the listener. It's an exercise in musicology as well.
I suppose you could call it that, yes. But the whole idea of this, the main object, was to get as close to how I felt that the manuscript would have been sung or should have been sung at that particular time in the 14th century.
Let's have a listen to another.
Thank you.
from the Rimini Antiphonal. You're with John Cleary, my guests, Meredith Lorne and Neil McEwen. Meredith Lorne, let's go back to talking about the work of Neri de Rimini, and how this work has come to Australia. Because we're talking about a pretty large object here. A number of folios included in sort of some wooden boards. I mean, you would think that something as important as this and dating back to the 14th century would have been known and celebrated in Australia for some time, that we have such a manuscript in our possession. How did it come to be and why did it remain sort of quiet for so long?
Oh, well, the State Library received this as part of a bequest from a man named Nelson Moore Richardson in 1928.
So we've had it lying dusty on the shelves for some time.
Yes, it has been known about and mentioned in a couple of books in the 60s and then the 80s. But then,
so what brought it to light at the moment? What's given it its current sort of status?
Well, we have a heritage gallery at the library where staff are invited to display special treasures from our collection, and so I chose to display the Rimini Antiphonal in this past year, and Neil was passing through and saw it there and, like most people, was surprised that this Italian medieval manuscript was sitting in our collection, and he got in contact with me and we started talking about a performance.
Was it a surprise to find out just how important a document it was? I mean, how long has it been known that it is the work of Neri de Rimini, an important illustrator from that period?
Well, that really came about in 1995 because the library received a request to send our antiphonal back to Rimini in Italy for a special exhibition celebrating the work of Neri de Rimini. Now, at that stage when we sent it, we thought that the artist was just one of his assistants or associates. But when it was at the exhibition and you could compare it side by side with all his other works, it was confirmed that it was definitely by Neri himself. And furthermore, the art experts that were there at the exhibition had a special look at it at the end of the exhibition. And under ultraviolet light, they looked at a very faint inscription on the first folio, which was partly abrased anyway. And they found, to their great surprise, in Roman numerals was the date of the completion of the manuscript, 1328. And that makes it the latest extant work by Neri in existence today.
We should say, too, that there's an added sort of Da Vinci Code layer to this, isn't it? In that it's what's called a parmenset. That is, the some of the writing, the music on it, had been scraped off at some point, even though the illustrations were left. The music itself had been scraped and rewritten, so there was a double decoding going on.
Yes, it's fascinating to look at it now, and on 45 of the folios, we see that someone in the late 16th century has gone through and scraped away the old notes and text and written over the top of them, and sometimes it was too hard without sticking a piece of paper over the old text. So, I mean, we wouldn't dream of defacing a book like this now, but it was a working document back then and they were still using it.
Any damage to the original Rimini illustrations?
No, thankfully all of those pages were left intact. And in fact, they left the responsories altogether and just changed some of the antiphons.
Let's have a listen to another selection from the Rimini manuscript.
Oh.
On ABC Radio, John Cleary with you, my guests Meredith Lawn and Neil McEwen, uncovering an exciting treasure, a treasure from Australia's libraries, which is a value around the world, not only as an illustration of the work of the 14th century artist Neri de Rimini, but as an example of 14th century Gregorian chant. Neil McEwen, let's talk about Gregorian chant for a moment and why it's significant. A few years ago, for those who can remember, there was a bit of a pop moment for Gregorian chant back in the early 90s, I think it was, when Canto Gregoriano was being sung around the world and Spanish monks became terribly popular. This is actually the musical style which underwrites much of Western music. Even pop music today can trace its origins back to Gregorian chant.
The writing down of these first neumes is the first notation, and you can, from modern notation, you can follow back fairly easily, and see where the notes actually came from. They're all from the early notation. I think it's something to do with the imagination. There's something within us all that just has this sense of enjoying medievalism. You'll remember the wonderful film, The Name of the Rose, where we're thrust back into the 13th century, where we have this Franciscan sleuth, and we're in the scriptorium, and what happens? In fact, we see some of the historiated letters with the Pope as a fox, etc., and this brings it all to life for us. But the actual chant itself, many people have loved just listening to Gregorian chant. In fact, my first experience was lying on a floor with a glass of red wine and just letting it waft over me, having no idea that it's so tightly wound up with the text. In fact, the music of Gregorian chant comes right out of the text. It is illustrating the subtleties of the special syllables, etc.
It's the way of saying the text together, in a sense.
It is. There's no music that you can get as close to the word and melody as you can in Gregorian chant, not even in the 21st century.
So it, in a sense, it's music for participation, not just listening.
Oh, quite. You have to put your mind back 1,000 years and put yourself into a monastery and imagine that these hours that we're talking about from the Rimini Antiphonal, the bell goes and whatever you're doing, you're in the garden or you're in the scriptorium, you meet in the chapel, and you sing psalms for 10 minutes to Gregorian chant. This is part and parcel of the heart of the living, praying monastery. And
so there's a sense in which it has a simple line,
yes,
but a simple line which has a little complexity added to it, but not too much. Enough complexity to make it interesting for you, but not too much so you can't remember it.
Well, on the contrary, John, it can become very complex. In fact, in one of the Alleluias, there's 100 notes to one syllable, if you want to go that far. But just harking back to what you were talking to Meredith about with the reform in the 16th century, the idea was to cut all these 100 notes, melismas as we call them, right back to about 2 or 3 a syllable. It reminds me of the question that Franz Joseph was asked when he heard Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. He said, "Too many notes."
Let's have an example of the way this music developed. And we'll go to the 16th century, that period we've been talking about, and Robert White, Christeki Lux. Just explain to us, introduce this piece to us as an example of something that flowed out of that earlier music.
Even though the reforms were happening or in place or passed in the Reformation, but in this particular case in England, Gregorian chant still played a very, very important part. In fact, even today, in many places, the Kyrie is always sung to Gregorian chant, and then you have the settings for the latter part of the Mass. And many compositions were based on Gregorian motives. So to break up the concert of Gregorian chant, I felt that we need to relax into just some 4 or 5 part harmonic construction to give the ear a rest, but based on Gregorian motives. And this particular one is a very, very beautiful work by White, probably written in the time of Mary Tudor, 1553 to 1558. because it's in Latin, although that's not the only reason. The Latin was also sung in Elizabeth's time. And I think that the chant plays an important part because it keeps coming back in between the polyphonic sounds.
Oh.
music of Robert White. On ABC Radio, John Cleary with you, my guests, Meredith Lawn and Neil McEwen. We're talking about the Rimini Antiphonal, a remarkable book in the possession of the State Library of New South Wales, containing illustrated manuscripts of Gregorian chant that take us back to the 14th century and earlier. Meredith Lawn, we were talking a little about the nature of this book and how it came into the possession of the Library of New South Wales, but just the sort of technical details of how it got here. It's mixed up with the First World War.
Yes, this English gentleman, Nelson Moore Richardson, who bequeathed it to us, he had an Australian camp, a convalescent camp, based on his land in Dorset during the First World War. And he was very impressed with the Australians that he met passing through that camp. And he would have shown them his collection of mainly early English Bibles. He was a keen antiquarian book collector. And he even showed it to the army chaplain, Reverend Reginald Pitt Owen. And he thought it would make a nice gift to Australia if, when he died, he let this collection go to Australia, and sort of to thank them for their contribution in the war.
And Reginald Pitt Owen sent it to his home state of New South Wales.
Yes, he suggested Sydney would be better than Melbourne, and we're inclined to agree. But the amazing connection with Pitt Owen, and why I wanted to mention him, was that just by chance, his great-granddaughter was singing in our concerts.
Was this a surprise, Neil, or something that that you were able to engineer?
Well, it was. I was just having a conversation with Julia Pitt Owen's father, who sings in our big choir at Christchurch St Lawrence, and he said, "I remember my mother talking about this because there's a letter that my grandfather wrote once to my father, saying, talking about this place that he was and all these Bibles." So he went back into the archives that his mother had at home and came back and he said, "It's my grandfather who suggested that they should come to the library." And amongst these Bibles must have been the Rimini manuscript.
Wonderful, wonderful piece of synchronicity. Yeah.
And then just by chance, they both sing in the choir at Christchurch St Lawrence.
How fabulous. It gives us a sort of real emotional content to the performance. Yeah. Tell us about the rest of this collection, Meredith. Are the Bibles there as well?
Yes, we have them in our rare books collection.
Any of particular significance?
Well, there's a Coverdale translation from 1535 and Tyndale's translation of the New Testament from 1536.
And these are original editions,
these
are they?
Like first editions. Very
wonderful.
Rare. I think there's only a couple of those Tyndales in existence now. But that's just a small portion. There were 300 in the collection.
So. What sort of valuation does a library put on such a collection? I mean, how do you do it for a start, and what is it worth?
Well, that I would leave that to the antiquarian book dealers to help with valuations.
Given the world significance of just two of those Bibles you mentioned, and you now have this Rimini document, what sort of excitement was there among sort of world scholars when the provenance of this Rimini Antiphonal was established?
It received a lot of attention in 1995 when it went back to Rimini to participate in an exhibition of the work of Neri de Rimini. So it had a chapter in the guidebook, which would have then let the whole international community know about it. That's when they discovered the date on it.
And are people keenly writing scholarly articles about it?
There's been a few, and I'd like to acknowledge one in particular by John Stinson, a Melbourne academic who has looked very carefully at all the music in it.
Neil, your performance, I mentioned the musicology of it before. This is clearly meant by you, as well as being a performance, as being a contribution to the scholarly understanding of Gregorian chant and the way it was performed and the way its performance developed. So as a conductor and interpreter, your work is a contribution to understanding as well.
Well, I like to think that if we're going to go back to the past and look at music, that the performance practice should get, you know, as close as we can by our understanding of reading and through theses and through other documents to find out how close we can get to performance. And looking at these earlier manuscripts, you're well on the way of knowing how things worked.
Yes, but you, as you said before, it's one thing to have the notes on the page, another thing to go back and find how you should interpret those. That is what we would call today the articulation marks, crescendo, diminuendo, all of that sort of stuff was stripped off this. You had to go back to the 10th century to find out how to do that. So you've brought these things together. Now, you're making a contribution in your performance, which is not only interpreting the work in terms that you think is technically correct, but you're also making an argument to other scholars. You're saying, this is the way I think this is intended to go.
Yes, it's based on good, solid research. I'd like to think that what we're doing is the right way to do it. And in training the voices with the six men was a little bit of a challenge at the beginning, but most of them have sung Gregorian chant with me, so it was only one rehearsal that we were really into the feeling, and you have to feel it as six people, as one.
And that's the other point, of course. Added to all of that comes your sense of interpretation on hearing the music. At what point does art come into it?
Well, it plays a very big part. The empathy of my empathy and the musicians who are doing it, we make some decisions musically and to do with the sound of how loud we go. I mean, the indication is only on the page that we might need to extend this note. How far do we extend it? We don't know. It's a matter of empathy and feeling. And every performance is like that. No one performance is ever going to sound the same.
Neil McEwen and Meredith Lawn, it's been great to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for exploring the Rimini Antiphonal. Music of the Rimini Antiphonal on Sunday night. Stick around for more music of Easter after the news with John Carmody.